Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
To the Middle East now, where Hamas has pulled out of high-level peace talks aimed at securing a ceasefire in the long-running conflict in Gaza. The news comes 2 weeks after the assassination of the man who was leading those efforts for Hamas during a trip to Iran. Meanwhile, the violence in Gaza continues. 19 Palestinians were killed yesterday, including a mother and her four-day-old twins. In a moment, we're going to consider the wider impacts of the conflict, particularly on consumer prices here. But for the latest from the Middle East, we're joined by defence editor, The Economist, Shashank Joshi. Shashank, the suggestion is being made by President Biden now that Iran might be dissuaded from attacking Israel as retribution for the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh if there was to be a ceasefire in Gaza. Where, though, does this proposal come from? Is it being made originally by Iran itself?
Well, Iran had previously said, even prior to President Biden's comments, that it would ensure its retaliation did not disrupt a ceasefire. And it was always known that ceasefire talks were going to come to a head about this time, I think on the 15th or so. And so in that sense, Biden is picking up on Iran's comments and what is logically, you would imagine, Iran's desire not to be seen as the obstruction to talks, because, of course, they're ostensibly conducting their activity in support of the Palestinians. And he's running with it to say, we're very close to a ceasefire. Surely you, Iran, don't want to be the one that will cause this to collapse. It's also possible, but I don't know this for sure, Iran may have sent private messages to the Americans and others saying, if you can persuade Israel to achieve a proper ceasefire, then we will hold back, even though we've said we will retaliate. So there may be a lot of private diplomacy going on here as well.
How, though, do you think that something like this is going to be received by hardliners within Israel? If you do X, we will do Y. That's probably not going to go down very well, is it?
Well, no, but of course, we've seen reports out of Israel in recent days and weeks anyway, suggesting that Benjamin Netanyahu, who is ultimately the man who makes these decisions, was working against a deal. What I mean by that is that he was seen to be adding additional requirements and amendments to an earlier text of a ceasefire deal that were seen by even some Israeli officials as being obstructionist. And we can go into those details on the ceasefire. But the point really here is that it's not clear whether the Israeli leadership really wants a deal or whether Netanyahu thinks he can eke this war out, both to keep degrading Hamas, but also to aid his own political survival.
How clear is it that the Americans really want a deal here? Because they have undoubtedly got a huge amount of leverage, which they have used in the past. But I see that the US has just approved the sale of a further $20 billion worth of arms to Israel.
America absolutely wants a deal, but as you point out, there are questions over its willingness to really use its leverage over Israel to force Israel into that deal. And I think that's always been the complaint from critics of Israel and critics of the United States, that they're not honest brokers in this. They have heavily armed Israel. They have enabled its war. They, in providing air defense over Israel, which of course America would see as right and proper, not allowing Israeli civilians to be killed, they say that this is giving the Netanyahu government a degree of immunity to prosecute the war. Of course, in practice, there is such staunch support for Israel in Congress, which has to approve these deals, that it's difficult to see how that would be otherwise. But the timing is absolutely curious. You know, you might think the Biden administration, which is frankly fed up of what it sees as this recalcitrance and obstruction from the Israeli leadership, the timing of this arms deal before a ceasefire is, I think, interesting and curious.
All positions seem to be hardening here as this goes on. Is there anything to change the dynamic? I mean, I've seen some speculation recently that releasing the Palestinian Mandela, a man called Marwan Barghouti, from custody, somebody who would be equally appealing to both the Hamas and Fatah factions of Palestinian society, might be something that would break the logjam. Do you see anything here that can shift the dynamic?
Well, the person you're referring to, Marwan Barghouti, is a very important figure because he's not a Hamas leader. He's associated with the rival faction that runs the West Bank, Fatah, which runs the Palestinian Authority. And polls published earlier this year show that if there was an election for a Palestinian leadership, Barghouti would win more votes than basically both his nearest rivals combined. So he's immensely popular. He, of course, as you allude to, is serving many life sentences in Israel for his role in a violent uprising known as the Intifadas, and that's obviously, you know, would have to be resolved. If he is released, that could precipitate changes in the Palestinian position. It could bridge the gap between Hamas and Fatah. Hamas, of course, having taken over Gaza, pushing out its rivals Fatah. But I must say that Hamas is still really not truly committed to a two-state solution, and the fact is they've just appointed the head of their military wing, Yahya Sinwar, who masterminded the October 7th massacres, as their political head to succeed Ismail Haniyeh, who was killed by Israel a few weeks ago. And so that doesn't bode well. And on top of that, this Israeli leadership, which depends for its political survival on a far-right coalition, also simply does not believe in the prospect or desirability of a Palestinian state. So even with Barghouti's release, I'm sorry to say I'm not terribly optimistic about things.
Okay, well, it seems there's no way to break the logjam there. Shashank Joshi, defence editor with The Economist, thank you very much. Let us turn then, seeing as there is no short-term solution here, to the wider economic and logistical implications of this conflict as it continues to play out. To analyse this, we're joined by the Director of Advisory Practice in Supply Chains with PwC, Mark McKeever. Thank you very much for coming into us, Mark. Tell us first, please, what ongoing impact is the blockade of the Red Sea by the Houthis in support of the Palestinians in Gaza having?
Yeah, I think, Philip, the biggest impact is that it is delaying shipping. So it's taking about an extra 20 days because ships are getting rerouted down towards the Cape of Good Hope and around Africa. So that's the kind of the impact. And that's what that is doing is it's essentially taking out capacity. What is happening then is, I think there's two or three impacts coming out of that. So firstly, you got that kind of reduced capacities along our trade routes. You have secondly got a lot of people are now shipping, particularly to get into peak season for the Christmas and everything like that. They're starting to ship early. And then you got also got concerns of an escalation in tariffs and potential trade wars coming up. So what's actually happening is you've got all these factors which are driving a huge increase in demand, and therefore the price containers is increasing quite dramatically. So to give an example, like a container, a 40-foot container from the Far East into Northern Europe, last year that would have been about $1,500. That went up to about $5,000 in February and is now hitting $8,000.
Good
Lord.
You
can see it's quite an impact. So
wow, that is a substantial increase, isn't it? I wonder then, when you add into that that we're also seeing a constriction on shipping that can come through the Panama Canal because of climate change reducing the amount of fresh water that they're able to put into the locks there, how great an additional cost is that adding to shipping?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously impacting because, and that's more the trade over kind of North America and that side of the world. So that's having an impact. So when you add both together, you have a huge cumulative impact of getting product from the Far East in consumer markets. So I think, you know, in the short term, it's definitely leading companies to, really focus on how they can get better visibility of products and also probably increasing stock levels. I think longer term, though, and this is probably more interesting, is you're probably going to see a change in how companies are managing their supply chains. So, for example, you know, you're going to see more regionalization. So, in other words, less dependence on the Far East and actually more kind of local nearshore production. To give an example, in PwC, we recently did a global supply chain survey. And what we found is, you know, 40% of companies at the moment have initiatives on to regionalize supply chains. Indeed, 11% of companies told us they've already regionalized supply chains. So for an example, you know, it could be a clothing manufacturer that used to manufacture everything in the Far East. They may now say, actually, you know what, we're going to take some of our manufacturing and put it into kind of Eastern Europe or Southern Europe as an example.
Even if you don't shift production, if you do adjust your stock levels in order to take account of what is happening, that requires extra storage, which is also an additional cost.
Absolutely, you're increasing your warehousing costs.
So what are the goods that you're seeing are being most affected?
I think at the start of the crisis, the area that was probably most impacted was the automotive industry. And if you think of the automotive industry, you know, they would have relied on just-in-time manufacturing. So like, you know, for example, you know, as well documented, Tesla, for example, have a plant in Germany that was impacted. Same with Volvo. But I think, you know, that's kind of subsided now for the moment. So I think those initial impacts are probably, I think companies have got over those. My concern, Philip, is as we start heading into peak and, you know, there's going to be more and more demand in shipping. And even though some companies are starting to bring in their Christmas orders early, wouldn't be surprised in the next 3-4 months you start seeing some gaps. I don't think it'd be alarming, but you might just see some gaps.
And that Christmas might just be that very little bit much more expensive. Is this going to have an inflationary upward pressure?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, at the start of the crisis, economists were projecting it might be in the order of kind of 0.3, 0.4%. And just to probably put a bit of context in, like shipping costs are typically about 1.7% of the cost of a consumer good. So if you're buying a pair of jeans, for example, or €100, be about 1.70 as an example. As the crisis prolonged, you know, and those costs, as I said, you've gone from about 1,500 to 8,000. Accounts are now saying actually the impact, you know, the companies are going to have to start passing that on. I've read that there might be 0.7% of an impact in inflation. I think the key point to note, though, is it's relative, like shipping costs and overall costs of consumer goods are relatively low. I mean, one economist kind of described it as small beer compared to all the other inflationary impacts in terms of energy crisis and so on and so forth.
I was going to say, I mean, if we were to have a cold winter and we were in need more gas, and we've seen what's happened to gas prices, that's going to have a much, much more serious impact than this is going to have.
Exactly. And that's why I think it's relatively, you're probably talking about 0.7%, something of that magnitude.
Okay. But still, adding 0.7% into the mix when we central banks think that they have just begun to get a handle on inflation, it's not desirable, is it?
Absolutely not, no. So that's I think the short-term impacts anyway. Okay. But I think longer-term, as companies start to reconfigure their supply chains, like, you know, again, that kind of survey I kind of alluded to earlier, you know, like 52% of companies told us that they're now re-engineering their supply chain in response to disruptions. Because you must remember,
Let's just be realistic about this for a second. Pivoting your production from the Far East to Europe is not the work of 3 or 4 or 6 months, is it? I mean, you're talking about years.
Yeah, it's a long-term project, absolutely. It's not something you can do very quickly. Okay. But I think the point I'm going to make is this disruption we're having at the moment is we've had a history over the last couple of years of ongoing disruptions. You're talking about the kind of Ukraine war, the energy crisis, COVID before that, and even Japanese earthquakes.
The poly crisis.
Exactly. So I think what companies, and this is one thing that really came out in our survey, companies are having to get a lot more agile in how they continuously deal with disruptions. And that's why I said to you, like 52% of companies told us they're actually re-engineering their supply chain to manage ongoing disruptions, because that is coming into new norm.
The age of disruption. Mark McKeever, Director of Advisory Practice in Supply Chains with PwC. Thank you very much. Let's take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.